From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Guide by Ramsey Campbell. In the quarter century since the publication of his first collection, The Inhabitant of the Lake, Ramsey Campbell has become one of the pillars of modern British horror fiction. He has received the World Fantasy Award twice and the British Fantasy Award a record 4 times. The used bookshops seem to be just as useless. And the first Q felt as if he had committed a gaffe by asking for the wrong James, or even by asking for a book. The woman who was minding the next bookshop, her lap draped in black knitting, so voluminous that she appeared to be mending a skirt she had on, assured him that the bookseller would find him something in the storeroom. "He's got lots of books in the back," she confided to Q, and as he leaned on his stick and leafed through an annual he'd read 70 years ago, she kept up the commentary. "Fond of books, are you? I've read some books. Books I'd call books. Make you sneeze, though, some of these old books. Break your toes, some of these books, if you're not careful. I don't know what people want with such big books. It's like having a stone slab on top of you, reading one of those books." As Q sidled towards the door, she said ominously, "He wouldn't want you going before he found you your books." "My family will be wondering what's become of me," Q offered and fled. Holidaymakers were driving away from the beach, along the narrow street of shops and small houses encrusted with pebbles and seashells. Some of the shops were already closing. He made for the newsagents in the hope that though all the horror books had looked too disgusting to touch, something more like literature might have found its way unnoticed into one of the shelves. And then he realized that what he'd taken for a book lover's front room, unusually full of books, was in fact a shop. The sill inside the window was crowded with potted plants and cacti. Behind them, an antique till gleamed on a desk, and closer to the window, poking out of the end of a shelf, was a book by M.R. James. The door admitted him readily and tunefully. He limped quickly to the shelf and sighed. The book was indeed by James, Montague Rhodes James. It was a guide to Suffolk and Norfolk. The shopkeeper appeared through the bead curtains of the doorway behind the desk. "That's a lovely book, my dear," she croaked smokily, pointing with her cigarette, "and cheap." Q glanced at the price penciled on the flyleaf. "Not bad for a fiver," he had to admit, and only today he'd been complaining that although this was James' country, there wasn't a single book of his to be seen. He leafed through the guide, and the first page came to bore a drawing of a bench end, carved with a dog-like figure, from whose crin a severed head dangled by the hair. "I'll chance it," he murmured, and dug his wallet out of the pocket of his purple cardigan. The shopkeeper must have been too polite or too eager for a sale to mention that it was closing time, for as soon as Q was on the pavement, he heard her bolt the door. As he made his way to the path down to the beach, a wind from the sea fluttered the bright striped paper in which she'd wrapped a volume. Laura and her husband, Frank, were shaking towels and rolling them up while their 8-year-olds kicked sand at each other. "Stop that, you two, or else," Laura cried. "I did say you should drop me and go somewhere," Q said, as he reached them. "We wouldn't dream of leaving you by yourself, Teddy," Frank said, brushing sand from his bristling, gingery torso. "He means we'd rather stay with you," Laura said, yanking at her swimsuit top, which Q could see she hadn't been wearing. "Of course that's what I meant, old feller," Frank shouted as if Q were deaf. They were trying to do their best for him, insisting that he come with them on this holiday, the first he'd taken since Laura's mother had died. But why couldn't they accept that he wanted to be by himself? "Granddad's bought a present," Bruno shouted. "Is it for us?" Virginia demanded. "I'm afraid it isn't the kind of book you would like." "We would if it's horrible," she assured him. "Mom and Dad don't mind." "It's a book about this part of the country. I'd rather think you'd be bored." She shook back her hair, making her earrings jangle, and screwed up her face. "I already am." "If you make faces like that, no boys will be wanting you tonight at the disco," Frank said, and gathered up the towels and the beach toys, trotted to the car, which he'd parked 6 inches short of a garden fence near the top of the path, hoisted his armful with one hand while he unlocked the hatchback with the other, dumped his burden in, and pushed the family one by one into the car. "Your granddad's got his leg," he mumbled when the children complained about having to sit in the back seat, and Q felt more of a nuisance than ever. They drove along the torturous coast road to Cromer, and Q went up to his room. Soon Laura knocked on his door to ask while he was coming down for an aperitif. He would have invited her to sit with him so that they could reminisce about her mother. But Frank shouted, "Come on, old feller, give yourself an appetite. We don't want you fading away on us." Q would have more of an appetite if the children hadn't swapped terrific jokes throughout the meal. "That's enough now," Laura kept saying. Afterward, coffee was served in the lounge, and Q tried to take refuge in his book. It was more the M.R. James he remembered nostalgically than he could have dared hope. Comic and macabre images lay low amid the graceful sentences. Here was that mysterious being, Sir John Shorn, rector of North Marston, who was invoked against Egg, but his only act was to conjure the devil into a boot, the occasion and sequel of this being alike unknown. Here were the St. Albans monks who bought 2 of St. Margaret's fingers, but who, Q wondered, were the crouched friars who had 1 little house at Great Wiltham. Then there were the 3 kings of young knights who are out hunting and pass a churchyard, where they meet 3 terrible corpses, hideous with the ravages of death, who say to them, "As we are, so will you be," a popular subject for decorating churches, apparently. Other references were factual, or at least represented as such. Not only a rector named Blastus Godley, but a merman caught in Orford in the 13th century, who could not be induced to take an interest in the services of the church, nor indeed to speak. Q's grunt of amusement at this attracted the children, who had finished reading the horror comics they persuaded their father to buy them. "Can we see?" Virginia said. Q showed them the sketch of the bench end with a severed head, and thought of ingratiating himself further with them by pointing out a passage referring to the tradition that same Erasmus had his entrails wound out of him on a windlass, the kind of thing the children's parents tried half-heartedly to to prevent them from watching on video cassettes. Rebuking himself silently, he leafed in search of more acceptable macabre anecdotes, and then he stared. "Granddad," Bruno said as if Q needed to be told, "someone's been writing in your book." A sentence at the end of the penultimate chapter. It is almost always worthwhile to halt and look into a Norfolk church. Had been ringed in grayish ink, and a line as shaky as a circumscription led to a scribbled paragraph that filled the lower half of the page. "I hope they knocked a few quid off the price for that," old fellow Frank said. "If they didn't, I'd take it back." "Remember when you smacked me," Laura said to Q, "for drawing in one of Mummy's books?" Frank gave him a look which Q found so disturbing that he could feel himself losing control, unable to restrain himself from telling Laura that Virginia shouldn't be dressed so provocatively, that the children should be in bed instead of staying up for the disco, that he was glad Laura's mother wasn't here to see how they were developing. He made his excuses and rushed himself up to his room. He should sleep before the dull sounds of the disco made that impossible. But he couldn't resist poring over the scribbled paragraph. After a few minutes, he succeeded in deciphering the first phrase, which was underlined. "Best left out," it said. If the annotation described something better than the book included, Q would like to know what it was. Studying the phrase had given him a headache, which the disco was liable to worsen. He got ready for bed and lay in the dark, improvising a kind of silent lullaby out of the names of places he'd read in the guidebook. Great snoring and creeding St. Mary, Bradfield, Combust, and Breckles and Snape, Herringfleet, Rattlesden, Chipley and Weeding, Bungay and Blackling and Dis. Almost asleep, too much to be so troubled by the draught that could be heard rustling paper near his bed, he wondered if the scribbled phrase could mean that the omission had been advisable. In that case, why note it at such length? He slept and dreamed of walking from church to church, the length and breadth of East Anglia, no longer needing his stick. He found the church he was looking for, though he couldn't have said what his criteria were, and lay down beneath the ribbed vault that somehow reminded him of himself. Laura and the children came to visit him, and he sat up. "As I am, so will you be," he said, in a voice whose unfamiliarity dismayed him. They hadn't come to visit but to view him, he thought, terrified of doing so himself. It seemed he had no choice, for his body was audibly withering, a process which dragged his head down to show him what had become of him. Barely in time, his cry wakened him. If the dream meant anything, it confirmed that he needed time by himself. He lay willing his heartbeat to slacken its pace. His eardrums felt close to bursting. He slept uneasily and woke at dawn. When he limped to the toilet, his leg almost let him down. He hawked, splashed cold water on his face, massaged his hands for several minutes before opening the book. If he couldn't read James' ghost stories, then viewing a location that had suggested one of them might be as much of an experience. The book fell open at the scribbled page, and he saw that the line beneath the phrase he'd read last night wasn't underlining after all. It led from the next word, which was map, across the page and onto the foredge. Rubbing together his fingers and thumb, which felt dusty, he opened the book where the line ended at a map of Norfolk. The line led like the first thread of a cobweb to a blotch on the Norfolk coast, where the map identified nothing in particular, showing only beach and fields for miles. The next scribbled phrase, however, was easily read. "Churchyard on the cliff, my old parish." It sounded irresistibly Jamesian, and not to his father's taste at all. In the hotel lounge breakfast, he read on. There was a man so versed in the black arts that he was able to bide his time until the elements should open his grave. Either Q was becoming used to the scrawl, or it grew increasingly legible as it progressed. He might have read more if the family hadn't come looking for him. "We're going to give Granddad a good day out today, aren't we?" Frank declared. "We said so," Bruno muttered. Virginia frowned reprovingly at him. "You have to say where we're going," she told her grandfather with a faintly martyred air. "How about to breakfast?" At the table, Q said to the children. "I expect you'd like to go to Hunstatton, wouldn't you? I understand there are dodgems and roller coasters and all sorts of other things to make you sick." "Yes, yes, yes," the children began to chant, until Laura shushed them. "That doesn't sound like you, Daddy," she said. "You can drop me off on your way. I've found somewhere I want to walk to that wouldn't have anything to offer you youngsters." "I used to like walking with you and Mummy," Laura said, and turned on her son. "That's disgusting, Bruno. Stop doing that with your egg." Q thought of inviting her to walk in the church with him, but he'd seen how intent Frank and the children had become when she hinted at accompanying him. "Maybe we'll have time for a stroll another day," he said. He sat obediently in the front seat of the car and clutched his book and his stick while Frank drove eastward along the coast road. Wherever he spoke, Frank and Laura answered him so competitively that before long he shut up. As the road swung away from the coast, the towns and villages grew fewer. A steam train paced the car for a few hundred yards, as if it were ushering them into James Era. A sea wind rattled across the flat land under a sky from which gulls sailed down like flakes of the unbroken cloud. On the side of the road towards the coast, the stooped grass looked pale with salt and sand. Apart from the occasional fishmonger stall at the roadside, the miles between the dwindling villages were deserted. By the time the car arrived at the stretch of road that bordered the unnamed area that the blotch of grayish ink marked on the map, Bruno and Virginia had begun to yawn at the monotonousness of the landscape. Where a signpost pointed inland along a road, an inn stood by itself, and beyond it, Q saw an unmarked footpath that led towards the sea. "That'll do me. Let me out here," he said. "Thirsty, old feller? This one's on me." Q felt both dismayed by the idea of being distracted from the loneliness of the setting and ashamed of his feelings. "They'll be open in a few minutes," Laura said. "Boring, boring," the children started chanting, and Q took the opportunity to climb out and close the door firmly. "Don't spoil the children's day on my account," he said, "or mine will be spoiled as well." Now he made it sound as if they were ruining his holiday. He patted Laura's cheek awkwardly, and then Virginia's, and leaned back from the open door. 5 o'clock here suit you," Frank said. "If we're late, there's always the pub." Q agreed and watched the car race away. The children waved without turning their heads, but Laura kept them in sight as long as she could. Just as the car reached the first bend, Q wanted to wave his stick urgently to call out to Frank that he'd changed his mind. 6 hours out here seemed a more generous helping of solitude than even he needed. And the car was gone, and he told himself that the family deserved a break from him. He sat on a rustic bench outside the building striped with timber and turned to the scribbled page while he waited for the door to be unlocked. He found he was able to read straight on to the end, not least because the ink appeared darker. There was a man so versed in the black arts that he was able to bide his time until the elements should open his grave. Only the passage of so many years and the stresses to which the falling away of the land subjected the grave twisted not only the coffin almost beyond recognition, but also what laid within. Imagine, if you will, a spider in human form, with only four limbs, a spider, both enraged and made ungainly by the loss, especially since the remaining limbs are by no means evenly distributed. If anything other than simple malevolence let him walk, it was the knowledge that whoever died of the sight of him should be bound to him. Q shivered and grinned at himself. So he could still derive a frisson from that kind of writing, all the more pleasurable when he remembered that James had never believed in his ghost. Was it really possible that Q was holding in his hands an unpublished episode by James? He didn't know what else to think. He gazed along the path through the swaying grass and wondered what it led to that had produced that description he just read, until the sound of bolts being slid back made him jump. The landlord, a hairy, bespectacled man, whose ruddiness and girth suggested that he enjoyed his beer, looked out at Q and then at the book. "Bit out of your way if you're walking, aren't you?" he said, so heartily that it served as a welcome. "Come in and wet your whistle, my lad." A bar bristling with decorated handles and thick as a castle parapet marked off a quarter of the L-shaped room, beyond which were a few small tables draped with cloths, and a staircase guarded by a visitor's book. The landlord hauled down the nearest handle and gave Q a mint of murky beer. "I was driven here," Q explained. "I'm just about to start walking." "Are you not using that book?" "Why, do you know it?" "I know all of man's works that's set around this countryside." "He had the touch and no mistake." The landlord poured himself a pint and drank half of it in one gulp. "But he didn't find anything round here that he wanted to write about." Q thought of showing the landlord the annotation, but wasn't quite sure of himself. "Do you know if he ever came this way?" "I should say so. He signed the book." Excitement made Q grip the handle of his tankard. "Could I see?" "Certainly, if I can dig it out. Were you thinking of eating?" When Q said that he better had, the landlord served him bread and cheese before unlocking a cupboard besides the stairs. Q glanced at the handwritten paragraph to remind himself what the writing looked like, and then watched the landlord pull out visitor's books after visitor's books and scan the dates. Eventually, he brought a volume to Q's table. "Here he is." Q saw the date first, 1890. He hadn't written any of his stories then, had he? "Not one." Q ran his gaze down the column of faded signatures and almost didn't see the name he was searching for. As he came back to it, he saw why he had passed over it. The signature bore no resemblance to the handwriting in the guidebook. He sighed and then sucked in a breath. The signature directly beneath James was in that handwriting. Was it signature A. Fellows? He touched it with his fingertip and tried to rub the cobwebby feel off of it off his finger with his thumb. Who was this, do you know? Whoever came with Monty James. The landlord seemed to be trying not to grin, and Q gazed at him until he went on. "You'd think these East Anglians would be proud to have James write about their countryside," the landlord said, "but they don't like to talk about this kind of stories. Maybe they believe in that kind of thing more than he did. The chap who ran this place was on his deathbed when he told my father about that signature. It seems nobody saw who made it. It's like one of Monty's own yarns." "Have you any idea where James had been that day?" "Some old ruin on the cliff," the landlord said, and seemed to wish he had been less specific. "Along the path outside?" "If it was, there's even less there now, and you'll have noticed that he didn't think it had any place in his book." The annotator had believed otherwise, and Q thought that was a mystery worth investigating. He finished his lunch and drained his tankard and was at the door when the landlord said, "I wouldn't stray too far from the road if I were you. Remember, we're open till 3. This felt so like the protectiveness Q had escaped earlier that he made straight for the path. Didn't anyone think he was capable of taking care of himself? He'd fought in the war against Hitler. He'd been a partner in an accountancy firm. He'd run every year in the London Marathon until his leg had crippled him. He'd tended Laura's mother during her last years and had confined himself to places where he could wheel her in her chair. And after all that, he wasn't to be trusted to go off the road by himself? James had followed the path, and it didn't seem to have done him any harm. Q stuffed the book under one arm and tramped towards the sea, cutting at the ragged grassy edges of the path with his stick. The fields of pale grass stretched into the distance on both sides of him, the low cloud featureless except for the infrequent serving gull glared dully above him. After 20 minutes walking, he felt he had scarcely moved, until he glanced back and found that the inn was out of sight. He was alone, as far as he could see. The grass of the fields came up to his shoulder now. A chilly wind rustled through the fields, and he limped fast to keep warm, faster when he saw a building ahead. At least, he thought, it was a building, until he was able to see through its broken windows. It was the front wall of a cottage, all that remained of the house. As he became abreast of it, he saw other cottages further on, and a backward look showed him foundations under the grass. He had been walking through a ruined village without realizing it. One building, however, appeared still to be intact. The church, ahead at the edge of the ruins. The church was squat and blackened with narrow windows and a rudimentary tower. Q had to admit that it didn't look very distinguished, hardly worth singling out for the guidebook. Though wasn't there a large gargoyle above one of the windows that overlooked the wide gray sea? In any case, the sight of the church, alone on the cliff top amid the fringe of nodding grass, seemed worth the walk. He threw his shoulders back and breathed deep of the sea air and strode towards the church. He needn't have been quite so vigorous. There was nobody to show off for. He had to laugh at himself, for in his haste, he dug a stick into a hole in the overgrown pavement and almost overbalanced. Rather than risk tearing the paper jacket by trying to hold into the guidebook, he let the book fall on the grass, where it fell open at the scribbled page. He frowned at the handwriting as he stooped carefully, gripping the stick, and wondered if exposure to sunlight had affected the ink. The first lines appeared blurred, so much so that he couldn't read the words, best left out at all. Perhaps the dead light was affecting his eyes, because now as he peered towards the church, he saw that there was no gargoyle. He could only assume that the wind had pushed forward the withered shrub, which he glimpsed swaying out of sight around the corner closest to the sea, and a trip of perspective had made it look as if it were protruding from high up on the wall. The church door was ajar, as Q limped the direction of the cliff edge. To see how stable the foundation of the building were, he discerned pews and an altar in the gloomy interior, and a figure in black moving back and forth in front of the glimmering altar. Could the church still be in use? Perhaps the priest was another sightseer. Q picked his way alongside the building, over illegibly weathered gravestones, whose cracks looked cemented with moss to the jagged brink, and then he shoved the book under the arm that held a stick, and grabbed the cold church wall to support himself. Apart from the slabs he'd walked on, the graveyard had vanished. It must have fallen to the beach as the centuries passed. The church itself stood at the very edge of the sheer cliff now, its exposed foundation sprouting weeds that rustled in the sandy wind. But it wasn't the precariousness of the building that had made Q feel suddenly shaky, in need of support. It was that there was no shrub inside the church. Nothing like the distorted, shrunken, brownish shape he'd glimpsed as it withdrew from light. Beside that corner of the church, the cliff fell steeply to the beach. He clutched the wall, bruising his fingertips, while he tried to persuade himself that the shrub and the portion of ground on which it stood had just lost their hold on the cliff, and then he shoved himself away from the wall, away from the crumbling edge. As he did so, he heard a scrabbling above him, on the roof. A chunk of moss, too large to have been dislodged by a bird, dropped on the grass in front of him. He clapped his free hand to his chest, which felt as if his heart were beating its way to the surface, and fled to the entrance to the church. The priest was still by the altar. Q could see the blotch of darkness that was his robe, and the whitish glint of his collar. Thoughts were falling over one another in Q's head. The guidebook was a late edition, and so the scribbled annotation must have been made decades later than the net signature at the end. Yet the handwriting hadn't aged at all. And couldn't the words in the visitor's book, which Q had taken for its signature, have been a follower? The only thought he was able to grasp was how far he would have to run across the deserted land from the church to the end. Too far for him to be able to keep up the pace for more than a few minutes. He dodged into the gloomy church, his stick knocking against a pew, and heard a larger movement overhead. "Please," he gasped, stumbling down the aisle into the dimness. He hardly knew what he was saying or doing, but where else could he go for help except to the priest? He wished he could see the man's face, though rather less fervently once the priest spoke. "It brought you," he said. It wasn't just his words, but also his voice that disturbed Q. Perhaps it was an echo that made it sound so hollow. But why was its tone so eager? "You mean the book?" Q stammered. "We mean what you read." Q was almost at the altar now. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that what he'd taken in the dimness of the draping pews and the altar was a mass of dust and cobwebs. More than the tone and timbre of the voice, its forced quality was beginning to unnerve him. "Your friend James thought it, but he didn't write it," the voice said. "We inspired him, and then I had to write it for him." If James had used a handwritten paragraph in one of his tales and identified the setting as he intended to, Q thought with a clarity of utter panic, more people would have visited this church. He was backing towards a door when he heard something clamber down from the roof and land just outside the doorway with a sound like the fall of a bundle of sticks and leather. "James nearly saw, but he didn't believe," said the figure by the altar, and stepped into the light that seeped through a pinched, grimy window. "But you will," it said out of the hole that was most of its face. Q closed his eyes tight. His panic had isolated a single thought at the center of him, that those who died of seeing would be bound to what they saw. He felt the guidebook slip out of his hands. He heard its echo clatter back and forth between the walls, and then it gave way to another sound of something that scuttled lopsidedly into the church and halted to wait for him. He heard the priest's feet, bare of more than clothing, begin to drag across the floor toward him. He turned, frantically tapping the pews with his stick, and shuffled in the direction of the door. Beyond it was the path, the inn, his family at 5 o'clock, further than his mind could grasp. If he had to die, please let it not be here. What terrified him most, as he swung the stick in front of him and prayed that it would ward off any contact, was what might be done to him to try and make him look.